Hello, it's Wednesday, 21st of July. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. What did you have for breakfast? How about adding a splash of booze, a tot of gin, to your marmalade? I'll tell you how to do it. Have you been pinged? Because if you have, legally, you are not obliged to isolate at home. I didn't know that either. Keir Starmer, oh dear, just over a year, the polls are still pretty dreadful. The latest putting the Tories 9 points ahead. How can that be when they've been in power for 11 years? I'll be talking to Keir Starmer's new biographer. But first, more than 8,500 migrants have crossed the channel. It's already broken a record for all of the number that passed in 2020. The Home Secretary's getting tough. I'm talking to a Labour peer who thinks she's getting too tough. ...8,452 migrants have made the perilous journey across the English Channel this year. They've already broken the record for migrants crossing the Channel in all of 2020. The Home Secretary, Priti Patel, has agreed to give France another £54 million to help prevent further illegal crossings. But this move has sparked controversy with some people. Joining me now is Lord Dubs. He's a Labour peer and campaigner for refugee rights. Lord Dubs, what's the problem with the Home Secretary trying to stop these crossings?
Well, she's right to try and stop them. What we've got to do is to catch the people traffickers who are vile people, who endanger the lives of refugees. So, of course, but she has already talked to the French last year, and there was another deal. So it's got to be done on the basis of cooperation with the French. If it works, well and good. But it's only part of the story. The whole point is that there are young people, children, child refugees in the Calais area who are desperate to join their families over here. And if they can't come legally, then they're going to come by other means. And what she's got to do, the Home Secretary, is to catch the traffickers, cooperate closely with the French, but also make sure there are legal paths for those people, particularly children, who've got some entitlement to be here.
Why do their parents abandon their children and leave them behind, Lord Dubs?
Well, there's one Syrian boy who said to me that he saw his father blown up in front of him by a bomb in Aleppo or Damascus.
Right.
These people have fled, but some of them have fled because they're young people. The Taliban want to recruit them into their forces, the same into their armies in East Africa. So some of the young men are more at risk of being dragooned into an army and fighting for Nazi regime.
Well, what risk are they in Calais, Lord Dubs? None whatsoever. They're in part of France, which is part of the European Union. It's a safe country. So why are they still trying to come to Britain?
Okay. Most of them, of course, do stay in France. The French take far more than we do.
Well, it's twice the size of Britain. Hang on, it's twice the size of Britain, France.
In population.
Well, it is. That's quite relevant. We're quite a crowded country, Lord Dubs.
Yeah, okay, we are. But look, we're talking about a very small number of people. Don't forget the 8,500 figure you quoted. There were more that have come in previous years, but they've stopped coming in the back of lorries mostly, and they're coming on these dinghies. But look, most of the refugees stay in France, and the ones that have a particular anxiety to come to Britain are children, young people who want to join their family members here.
But Lord Dubs, aren't some of them, be honest, they're economic migrants seeking a better life here. They want to practice their English, improve their English, and they think they'll get benefits and they'll get a job here.
Well, by that argument, they would be staying in France, wouldn't they? Because they wouldn't have to hazard the dangerous journey across the Channel. Now look. Of course, among them there are some economic migrants. Gosh, let's not be naive. That's the way the world is. What I'm saying is that those that have a well-founded fear of persecution, that are fleeing from war, persecution, violence, torture, and other threats, they're the ones that we should look at more kindly, not the others.
All right. I just, again, though, I thought the old rule was where they land, where they set foot, they should stay. I met some of these people have come through Greece, Spain, France. They've got no intention of staying there. They want to come to Britain because they want to improve their English.
Well, first of all, the vast majority want to go to Germany, Sweden and France. If you talk to the people in the refugee camps in Greece and elsewhere, their aims are to go elsewhere. But look, if one applied that policy, the policy of saying they should claim asylum in the first safe country they would get to, there wouldn't have been a million Syrians who have gone to Germany. There'd be a million sitting in Greece or in Italy or in Malta. And that's not how the world can work sensibly. We've got to share responsibility. And I'm arguing that Britain should share responsibility and take a small number of these people who are very vulnerable.
Don't we take quite a lot already from the refugee
camps?
No,
we had a scheme where we had a vulnerable person scheme where over a 4-year period we took 20,000, and that's from Turkey, Lebanon and Jordan. And whether that scheme will continue or not is something the Home Secretary has to announce, but I hope we'll do that, yes. Of course, if there are vulnerable people in the refugee camps and the United Nations can identify them, then yes, of course we should.
If I could ask you just finally, one of the proposals we think for the Home Secretary is that migrants, illegal immigrants, call them what you will, asylum seekers, refugees, will be removed from British soil and they'll have their applications processed somewhere else. Turkey has been mentioned. It's a scheme that's worked very effectively in Australia and they've got virtually no illegal migration now across the water. What would you make of that?
I don't like the idea. I've heard about this stay-in scheme, and I don't think it's working from people who've been watching it as well as you suggest. But look, turning back to this country, what's she going to do? Find a country that will agree to take people and leave them there? They'll be there, out of sight, out of mind. What rights will they have? Will they have access to friends, family, lawyers, or any sort of support? It seems that what the Home Office should do is to get itself efficient. Instead of having a waiting list of thousands and thousands trying to get see whether they can get asylum status, the Home Office should get on with it and make quick decisions, not dump the decisions onto another country and then have even longer delays. The Home Office needs to get far more efficient than they are to protect this country and indeed to be fair to people we're talking about.
All right, that's Lord Dubs. He's a Labour peer and he's a campaigner for refugee rights. Thanks so much for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to the Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. He's been Labour leader for just over a year, but Sir Keir Starmer's tenure has been, well, not great. A lack of direction, he's accused of, a humiliating loss in the Hartlepool by-election, and continued party infighting. So, how did the man elected with so much hope come to this? I'm joined by his unofficial biographer, Nigel Cawthorne. Nigel, you've written a book, Keir Starmer, The Reluctant Politician. Why do you call him that?
Well, it's one of those wonderful things that publishers change on you. Initially, the subtitle was A Life of Contrasts, but he seems to have done rather well for himself as a lawyer. And rose through the profession rather rapidly to become DPP. And he only seems to have taken an interest again in politics after being on the advisory board in Northern Ireland. He felt he really couldn't do much to change things and decided that he had to go rather back into politics because he was very interested in left-wing politics when he was at school.
And he became an MP quite late in life. I think it was 2015. He's only been in Parliament 6 years. The criticism many people make of him, they say, we don't know what he stands for, what his vision is, and is he a real leader? Nice guy, clever lawyer, that doesn't necessarily make you a good leader. And what is the vision thing? Have you unpeeled in this biography the real Keir Starmer, what sort of man he is?
Well, he's very much a man of contrasts. He's obviously fiercely intelligent and very competent as a lawyer. But, I think his delivery in the House of Commons, for example, comes over rather that he's addressing a jury rather than the nation.
Yeah, I think he sounds like a robot.
Well, yes, he has got that rather sort of flat and nasal sound to his voice, but the problem is he's really up against a man who's just charisma and almost nothing else. Whereas that's the very the one quality that Keir lacks
is charisma. He's a walking charisma bypass. You went to the same school as him? I know you weren't there at the same time, but the Keir Starmer you've written about, do you like him? Should the country like him? Should we embrace him more? Because I think the country doesn't really know him. Maybe this book will be the start of us getting to know him.
Well, I certainly hope so. I do rather like him. He's actually my MP too. I live here in his constituency. Yes, maybe I'd like to think a lot of these people do kind of warm to the role, and I kind of think that Boris kind of plays a cut price Churchill, and I just wonder whether that Keir is going to be a Clement Attlee, who was also rather dull but extremely competent.
And very successful, probably their most successful prime minister, because, of course, he had created the welfare state and all that. Was there an edict from him and his people for them not to cooperate with you during writing this book?
I don't know. I did ask for his help, but I didn't receive any. The school was quite helpful to me, though.
Yeah. Is there something if you had to say one thing about him that perhaps we don't know, but which we'll discover when we read your book, and it'll be on my desk very soon, I hope. What would it be?
One thing.
I know he's a football fan, mad Arsenal.
Yes, we all know that. We all know that. We know about the moisturiser, don't we?
We do.
He may be dull as a politician, but I think he's quite an interesting character, especially in the rather strange relationships with his parents, particularly his father. Now he kind of repudiates the name Rodney, which is his father's name, and I think his father was always rather distant. And he's one of those guys, rather like myself, you come from a relatively modest background, in his case a positively working class background, whose parents push you into the middle classes, essentially. And I'm sure that's why, although being a kind of a left-wing anti-monarchist, why he took the knighthood for his parents' benefit. So he comes across as very respectable and middle class, and living nearby here in North London, I think that probably alienates the rest of the country. And of course, being brought up working class in Surrey is not like being in Newcastle or Lancashire or something. That really doesn't come across, does it? But that's what he really is.
Yeah. Do you think it's a guessing game, of course, Nigel, just finally, but do you think Keir Starmer, the reluctant politician, is going to be the next Prime Minister?
Well, I think that he has such a mountain to climb, not only because of the factional fighting within the Labour Party, but how can the Labour Party get itself elected as government of this country without support in Scotland?
Yeah, that's a big problem. And he's been up there at least once since he became leader. He probably has to spend a bit more time up there. But if he thinks Boris Johnson's hard to lay a glove on, Mrs. Sturgeon, Nicola Sturgeon, she walks on water, I think, Nigel.
Indeed. Why can't she be Prime Minister of the United Kingdom?
Now, there's a thought, because she doesn't believe in the United Kingdom. That's the trouble. So we don't want her. Thank you very much. That's Nigel Cawthorne. He's the author of the first biography of Sir Keir Starmer, and it's called Keir Starmer, the Reluctant Politician, and you can buy it in bookshops right now. You can visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or me at Toryboypierce. So there's mounting public anger at the so-called pindemic, which has led to a mass revolt against the NHS COVID app and self-isolation rules. Statistically, you're more likely than not to be told to self-isolate if you haven't already deleted the NHS app. So what are your rights if you do get pinged? Ben Wilkinson is the deputy editor of Money Mail, and he joins me now. Ben, I have to say, I didn't know till I read your stuff today that you're not legally required to self-isolate if the dreaded ping hits your phone.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll confess as well, I didn't realise until I started looking into it. This is key, really. If you get contacted by the NHS test and trace team, you know, you get a phone call, you're legally obliged.
Yeah.
You have to stay inside for 10 days, and because it's a legal thing, you know you're entitled to all sorts of things, like you can get sick pay, and you know your employer is not much more likely to be sympathetic. But if it's a ping, you know, because you've been out at a coffee shop or a pub or a club now, you know, you're sort of morally obliged to self-isolate, but you're not legally required. So there's all sorts of questions for employees about, you know, whether they can afford to do that, especially if they're not going to get paid sick pay or...
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, Ben, what if your company say, well, I'm not legally obliged to pay you money. You're not here for 5 days or 10 days. To hell with it. And don't pay them. Can they then get some compensation from the government?
Well, there are, for the low paid and the people who cannot work at home, there are these £500 grants that you can apply for your local council. But from what I'm hearing, they're not being, you know, there's a big admin process, you know, in applying for one, and they're not necessarily handed out to everyone who goes for one. So I think as this problem gets worse, and people might have to self-isolate repeatedly, so they keep getting pinged, I think employers are going to find it increasingly difficult to afford it, and they're probably going to run out of patients.
Yeah, they're running out of staff. I've heard of bars and restaurants that have already had to close or only operate for 4 or 5 days, Ben, because they haven't got the staff. This is increasingly they're going to encourage people, isn't it, to either ignore the ping or just delete the wretched app in the first place.
Well, I think that is the danger. And I think at this sort of critical juncture at the with the pandemic and, you know, trying to keep infections down, they need to... you know, they need to help people to do the right thing, because at the moment there's a real danger that people are going to sort of, you know, ignore it and just
yeah.
The
mixed messaging coming out of the government don't help either. Paul Scully, he's the you've probably talked to him quite a lot, Ben. He's the business minister. He said not once, not twice, but three times it was a matter for individuals to decide whether to observe the quarantine if they're pinged. He was slapped down very quickly by Downing Street, but in my view, damage done.
Yeah, no, quite. And I think I think it's the Work and Pensions Committee today have written to the Health and Safety Executive to say, you know, we need some urgent guidance on this, because people don't really know what to do. They don't know what the right thing is to do. Yeah, so it's a lot of confusion, and it needs to be cleared up.
And we're stuck with this thing until the middle of August, Ben. We thought there might be some tweaking of the app to make it less sensitive, because we now know that doctors and nurses also have deleted the app or are ignoring it, but they're not going to do that. So we've currently got, I think, 1.7 million people currently self-isolating. That could double or even triple.
Yeah, no, so the review was announced by the health secretary because they were worried about how sensitive it was and the damage to the economy, but... they've sort of, you know, they've gone back on that because of the spiraling infection rate. So it does seem that we are trapped with this for another 3 weeks or so.
Yeah. What are you doing? Do you religiously check your app, Ben, or do you ignore it like I do?
I have to confess, I might have turned the Bluetooth off before I went on holiday. But
funny that.
No,
yeah.
I've got it on, and I haven't been pinged yet. But I am. I'm being cautious. I'm avoiding.
Well,
you know,
I'm
not going to let a coffee shop cost me.
I discovered the other day, I turned it on to have a look, and it said, you are now free from your isolation period. And I thought, terrific. I didn't know I had to be in an isolation period, because I completely missed the ping telling me to isolate for 5 days or something. So, and I was trying to be conscientious.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a mess in all of this, isn't it, Ben?
Yeah, the government haven't sort of covered themselves with glory on this one.
I'm afraid they haven't. That's Ben Wilkinson. He's deputy editor of Money Mail in the Daily Mail, and he's written all about the rules and regulations today. So have a look. Thanks for joining us. So what did you have for breakfast? And how about adding a splash of whiskey or something even stronger maybe to your marmalade? Because classic fruit spreads are now enjoying an edgy rebirth thanks to a growing demand for booze-infused products. Jennifer Williams is a specialist jam maker, and she owns the company Naked Jam. Jennifer, tell me all about it. Booze in marmalade, is that a new thing, or is it an old-fashioned thing that you're reviving?
It depends on how you look at it. If you're young, it's a new thing.
Yeah.
If you're my age, then it's something you're reviving. I mean, it's something that's always been around. Marmalade recipes have been around for a very long time. Jam recipes have been long for a long time. And different flavours and different things have always come in and out of vogue, as they do. But I think nowadays people are appreciating it more. Rather than just put it in as an extra added, this is put in as a improve the flavour of the fruit, improve the kick of the jam in the morning.
So when would it go into the process? So, for instance, if you were going to put some gin in the jam or maybe some whiskey in the marmalade, is it in the very beginning of the process? Or I suppose
depends
just,
which one it is.
Right.
Yeah, it depends what the fruit is.
Well, let's think about whiskey going in marmalade.
Whiskey going in marmalade. First of all, as I marinate the fruit overnight in its own juices and water, what I'd do is I'd add the whiskey to the orange peel itself, so infused into the peel or to the lemon peel, depending on what recipe I'm using. And then once I've cooked the marmalade, and as you know, it boils to a high temperature, jams and marmalade to get the set, as it comes off the boil and you finish, then I'd add another extra dram, as they'd say, of whiskey, just to flavour the orange juice and the orange of the marmalade or the lemon, depending on which marmalade you are making.
And how much?
So it's sort of a double add.
Yeah, so how much are you putting in the in a classic jar of marmalade? How much whiskey would be in there?
For a whole pot, it's very difficult to work out per jar, actually, because I only get about 8 pots of marmalade out of a jar, out of a pan, because I do all small batches. So I would literally put in about 120ml of whiskey. In a pot of marmalade, which gives you about 8 to 10 jars.
Right, but of course the alcohol content. Yeah, but the alcohol content is cooked off in the process, is it?
It is. Yeah. Yes, it is.
So you're not going to be drinking and driving.
Definitely not.
Right. Never know about these things. No, definitely not. And how popular are, because I am of a certain generation, Jennifer, so I had heard of alcohol-infused jams and marmalades, but how popular are they becoming for you?
Very popular. People are really sorting them out and really want them. And I think it's because it's, to them, it's a novelty.
Yeah.
They've been brought up on the, you know, just the general spread rather than something with different flavours. But it's kind of, all of a sudden, everyone's kind of, especially gin, everyone wants gin in everything, and gin doesn't always work in everything.
No.
And again, it's a different process of adding that to fruit to get the right flavour. But it's, it's very popular because people want to, I guess for me, I use them as cocktail adds as well. So you've got jam that's already infused with a bit of alcohol, then you could add that to a martini or whatever you're doing. So it kind of adds the next dimension. If you're making a boozy cake, you've got a boozy jam, and people are liking cocktails at the moment. So
Cool.
It's very popular. So it's just gone through the roof a little bit.
And are you, where do you make your jams? Are you a homemade producing at home? Have you got a little factory?
No, I've got a little tiny factory.
Right.
Little kit in the New Forest. It's purpose built, industrial, because I supply some hotels and retail shops and things.
Oh, so you've got all those lovely New Forest ponies wandering around near you. How nice.
We do. Yeah, it's gorgeous. I can't complain. I live in a very beautiful part of the world. The beach one side, the forest the other.
Oh, well. What's to love. And which is proving to be your most popular boozy product? Is it this whiskey or is it a jam?
It depends on the season. In the winter, the lemon whiskey one really goes well. And I think it all depends on the whiskey you use. I was reading nice whiskey, so it's quite handy. But in the summer, strawberry and champagne is a bestseller. People love strawberry and champagne.
Yeah, of course.
And then followed by a tequila slammer marmalade.
Oh, my word.
People like, because you can, you know, you add a bit of salt.
Yeah.
Tequila, And blue liquor.
And do you have to, the old rule when we were cooking, one for the pot, one for me, what about the, do you have to resist thinking, I might as well just have a little snifter of that whiskey, champagne?
I always have to try.
It would be rude not to, wouldn't it?
It would be rude not to, but also if you've got a new, I worked with Louis Pommery recently and I hadn't tried their fizz, so I had to have a glass first.
Of course,
because you need to know how much to put in.
Yes, that's your excuse, and it's a very good one. And how much?
It's a very good excuse.
A very good excuse. And what would a pot of your jam cost?
They start at £6.95.
Right.
So,
and I imagine is in the run up to Christmas, you're swamped.
In run up to Christmas, we're absolutely swamped, and this year I'm going to do sort of like a gift alcoholic, you know, the tipsy pack.
Right.
for the tipsy drinkers,
right.
Maybe the marmalade and then the jams and things.
And if people want to buy your stuff, Jennifer, do you have a website so they can find you?
I do have a website. It's www.naked-jam.co.uk.
I'm going to have a look. I fancy the strawberry and champagne.
It is nice.
Sounds it.
I use Vifklik and Louis Pommery, obviously. But that's not champagne. It's English sparkling.
Good enough for me. Certainly good enough for me. That's Jennifer Williams. She's a specialist jam maker, owner of the jam company Naked Jam. So do check her website out if you fancy a little tipple with your toast in the morning. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.